And finally for this month, I met Dr. Helen Walker from the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, who introduced me to MIRI.
MIRI is the mid-infrared instrument, which will actually fly on the James Webb Space Telescope. And the plan is that this instrument will operate, it's called the mid-infrared. It's about just off the red end of the spectrum that you can see. It's 5 microns to 28 microns. And it's a very important region of the spectrum because that's actually where we can start to see the very first galaxies at the very edge of the universe, just after they'd formed.
We're quite used to the idea of thermal infrared cameras. How does MIRI actually work? Is it just an adapted camera?
If only it were as simple that it was just an adapted camera. One of the blackest arts known is making an infrared detector. These are very special detectors. They're very sensitive. They're very low noise. For example, if you were trying to look at the Hubble Deep Field with MIRI, it's too bright. Those galaxies are way too bright for MIRI. You're now going to look for very, very faint galaxies, and so you want something that's incredibly sensitive. MIRI operates at 6.2 degrees above absolute zero, and that stops MIRI drowning out the signal from a faint galaxy with its own heat, and so we can actually start to look out and see the very cool universe.
And how will you keep it that cold? How will you get it down to its operating temperature?
MIRI will be cooled in several stages. There is a natural cooling with having the sunshield there, so it will certainly be down to about 200 Kelvin, 200 degrees above absolute zero. Then there will be various stages of mechanical cooler. We will not be using liquid helium. This is why we're a mid-infrared instrument rather than a long-wave infrared instrument, because then we don't need the helium. And we will actually be doing the cooling by mechanical means. It's a similar sort of system to the one you have in your fridge, where you can cool mechanically and you create the liquid and the liquid circulates and then it turns into a gas and turns back to a liquid. And you can do that by mechanical means. So that the plan is not to have any liquid coolant, like liquid helium, which evaporates and boils off, and then once you've emptied the tank, it's game over. This can keep going.
It must also be a challenge to filter out all of the visible light and all of the other light that would otherwise, again, drown out the signal and cause it to heat up.
The detectors on MIRI are not sensitive to visible light. They're specially built so that they operate only in the infrared region. We have a camera for MIRI and also some spectrometers which look at the kind of fingerprints from molecules and atoms. And they have special filters in front of them so that we can select very carefully which particular region we want to look at and which molecule.
And what sort of molecules are you actually going to be able to see?
We can actually look at a very wide range of molecules, but the one that is of particular interest is hydrogen. Hydrogen is very abundant in the universe. It's the most common element, and yet it's the most difficult molecule to spot because it has very few lines, and they're off in the infrared. And there's one particular line at 27 microns, which we can look at with MIRI, and we are really going to be chasing that one down all over the universe because it's very rare that you get the opportunity to observe the hydrogen molecule directly.
And as well as seeing this hydrogen that we so far haven't been able to see, what structures do you expect to see?
What MIRI will be looking for are galaxies just after they formed, the very first galaxies. They'll be visible because there'll be a lot of star formation going on. My own particular research interest is, shall we say, the other end, nearby stars, which have the sort of rubble left over from when the star was formed, which might make planets in the future. If we look at that in the infrared, we can see this very cold material as it's gradually forming into bigger and bigger lumps. And, of course, when you actually get a planet, that will start attracting all the material around it in the debris disk. And so hopefully with the 6.5-metre James Webb Space Telescope, we'll have enough resolution to actually see the gaps in the debris ring where the planet has formed. So it would be a bit like Saturn's rings, where you see all these little different types of ring. With us, it will be a case that maybe there's a planet in the middle there rather than one of those very small moons.
And that should help to enhance our knowledge of how planets form in the first place.
What we've found over the last 15 to 20 years is, now that we know there are planets out there, our whole theory about how planets formed is completely wrong. When you've got a sample of one, your own solar system, you make up some wonderful theories, and they were perfectly fine. They explained how our own solar system formed. But now we've gone elsewhere and looked elsewhere, and we can actually see these other planets. They are nothing like our solar system. And so our theories really need a radical overhaul. And the first problem is always, how do you start making a planet? We've now come to the conclusion that planets don't often form where they are currently. You know, we now think that some of the planets in our own solar system formed a lot further out than they are now and gradually migrated inwards. And it certainly must be the case with other planets around other stars, that they are forming in a very different place to where we see them. So if we can look back at these debris disks and start seeing where the planets are forming in those, it gives you a clue as to where to start with in your theory.
So not only does it allow us to image things we haven't been able to see before, but it gives us some new scientific answers. Going back to being able to see hydrogen, what scientific questions do you hope to answer with that?
When you're looking at hydrogen, you're looking at the most abundant element in the universe. With the molecular hydrogen, you're looking at the very coldest parts of the universe. So you're looking at the dust clouds, clouds of gas, before any stars have formed in them. As soon as you get a star forming, it, first thing it does is warm up the cloud. And so when we start looking at molecular hydrogen, we're looking at those places which are going to form stars a long way in the future. And if you can actually start seeing how much molecular hydrogen there is in that cloud, you can start to see whether this is a place that's got enough material in it to form a star in the few billion years' time. Ooh, not long, not long. Up until now, we've really had to wait until the star sort of started collapsing and forming and warming up the region so we can see it. Whereas with this, you could actually get there just before it happens.
So it should also answer questions about star formation as well as planet formation.
It will give us a big clue about star formation, because it is, again, a part of the universe that we've not really been able to look at very easily. Up until now, we've really relied on not the molecule of hydrogen, but the molecule of carbon monoxide, which always lives in close proximity because they like the same sort of temperature domain. And we can find carbon monoxide very easily with many ground-based telescopes, but we always then have to guess how much molecular hydrogen that implies is in the same cloud. So to actually go out there and say, well, yeah, you said there was 10 billion stars worth of molecular hydrogen in this cloud, well, you're out by a factor of 100, could make a big difference.
Miri is still on the ground here at Rutherford Appleton Labs at the moment. What's the plan for once it's up there? How will we further develop the science?
When we finally get Miri cold enough and working, I suspect the first thing we'll find is something completely different. We've already had one change of direction, because when Miri was first being planned and designed, we hadn't found any exoplanets. And so now, based on the experience of Hubble, where they hide the star behind the sort of crossbar wedge, we have coronagraphs on our instruments, so we can create artificial eclipse, remove the starlight from our detectors, and then look for exoplanets. And this is one of the things we're actually testing out during our test campaign on the flight model, to actually see how easily we could observe exoplanets using our instrument, which was never planned to do that.
Helen Walker from the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory. Join us next time for more space science news, interviews and answers to your questions. And do keep your comments and questions coming in by email to astronomy@thenakedscientists.com. You can follow the Naked Scientists on Twitter, at Naked Scientists, or you can just join us on Facebook, facebook.com/thenakedscientists. Naked Astronomy is produced by me, Ben Valsler, and comes to you from Cambridge University with support from the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Supported by the STFC, this is Naked Astronomy. For more information, look us up online at nakedscientists.com/astronomy.